Today we'll be talking about the world's favorite flavor. And I don't have a mouse. Basic outline, we'll jump right into it. So for those of you who aren't aware of our situation where we are, we're pretty much at the bottom of the world from a domestic point of view. We have a nice research facility, 160 acres, 17 faculty, covering everything from plant pathology to soils to horticulture and now plant breeding. We have what I consider an ideal climate with distinct rainy and dry seasons, though we do get rain throughout the year. Right now, we're in the peak of our rainy season. We do get freeze events in southern Florida, though they're rare. We haven't had one since I've been there, which I'm grateful for because I hate the cold. We are located south of Miami. We are flanked by the Everglades on one side and then water on two other sides in Miami to the north. So we're really constrained in terms of where we can grow. This also dictates what we can grow. So it has to be very high-value crops like horticultural crops. We are growing on a crushed limestone bedrock. And so this is an ancient coral sea. And they come in with heavy equipment and they bust up the substrate into these gravel-sized rocks, and that's what we grow in. So you can imagine all the nutritional challenges that we might have in an area like this. To show further the constraints, this is a picture when I was flying in the other day. At the bottom of the picture is the ocean, and the dark patch is the Everglades, and this is the land constraint that we have. So solid houses for this 15-mile stretch. You go farther south and there is just a patch of green where we supply most of the ornamental plants that the rest of the country enjoys, as well as tropical fruit production. My program works with a number of absolutely delicious tropical fruits and a number of different targets for those. So for example, working on the active ingredient in miracle fruit, niche and novel species like alpine strawberry production in South Florida, diversity in things like bananas, natural sweeteners in star fruit, disease-resistant passion fruit, bringing solo-type papayas to South Florida, lots of work with mango from sensory to breeding to genomics and genetics, and then vanilla, which is what I'll be talking about today. So some fast facts on vanilla. There's around 110 species, depending, of course, on how you define a species. But really, the global industry relies on two species that are legally defined for vanilla extract. You can only use Vanilla planifolia or Vanilla tahitensis, if you want to call it vanilla extract. It's important in foods and fine perfumes, including chocolates. If you like chocolate, we mask the bitterness in chocolate with vanilla. Vanilla has an interesting story, spread globally starting in the 1500s, Mesoamerican origin for cultivation. It's propagated by cuttings, which is great for ease of propagation, but that also led to the world producing very genetically similar clones around the world, which of course you start thinking about disease epidemics, as well as the lack of available diversity for trait improvement. We have some nice history in the United States with Vanilla planifolia, the commercial species, moving through Florida, Hawaii, and Puerto Rico in the early 1900s, and there was even a breeding program in Puerto Rico in the mid-1900s. Today, Madagascar dominates vanilla production with about 70% of the global supply, also arguably the best quality vanilla beans around the world. And this is a picture in Madagascar that I took a few months ago of the production system. It's really a jungle-based agricultural system. You get a piece of land, you go through, you clear out some of the shrubs. Anything that's a little bit taller than 3 feet, you can grow a vanilla plant on. Your yield is mostly dependent upon the natural nutritional health of the soil that you're growing on. Very few agricultural inputs in general, if any. So historically, breeding in most tropical fruits has involved these chance opportunities. So for example, you have Vanilla planifolia and Vanilla odorata growing close to each other. A natural pollinator makes a chance pollination, and you have a seedling that germinates, someone notices that it's different, and that's how we think we got tahitensis, though this doesn't actually match the model that we've developed that I'll show you in a few slides. While this might work well to find one acceptable improved species over centuries, of course today we take a much more calculated and measured approach. We want to combine favorable traits from both parents and put those into something that can help our growers remain profitable, and we do this in a repetitive fashion, always improving one generation upon another. What does vanilla breeding actually look like? So of course, like many other crops, you start with flowers from male and female parents. One of the nice things with vanilla is a single cross can give you tens of thousands to hundreds of thousands of seeds. So a lot of progeny in a single cross. We germinate these aseptically. They do take a long time to germinate, going from these hard black specks, which you might be familiar with in some of the ice cream that you buy. If you have good taste, you guys buy the good stuff. And they develop roots. We grow these up in test tubes, harden them off, and then eventually we can look at things like flavor quality and the aroma profiles and things like this. In order to cut our teeth in multiple areas at once, instead of going in linear fashion, we are able to work at each of these steps independently and then combine them so that when we have high-value crosses, we actually know what to do with them all along the way, including working with vanilla growers in Hawaii, which are providing us with some of these flavor extracts, asking when is it ready and which ones taste the best, things like this. One of my favorite quotes here is from Miguel Soto Arenas, renowned in the vanilla world, who said, "Cultivated vanilla planifolia is very similar to the wild plants of its species, and it really cannot be said to be a domesticated plant, since there has not been a selection or plant breeding." This is translated from Spanish, but I think the intent of the sentence is well communicated. We are growing a wild species, and that's what we are relying on. So especially those of you who are familiar with the history of your plants, think about things like wild apples and why we don't grow those now today for commercial production. Wild peaches, the same, blackberries, anything else you're going to talk about, right? And that's where we are today with vanilla. It is the out-of-the-jungle accessions that we're growing. And, of course, what types of things that we want to improve? Vanilla has very strong supply constraints. And so recently vanilla was trading per kilogram higher than silver, strictly because of supply constraints. Of course, we've got quality challenges, which can impact you as a consumer. Disease problems, like all crops. Uniformity mostly impacts the curing process, which I'll talk about in the next slide. Labor costs. So every single vanilla bean had that flower had to be manually pollinated. And the flowers are short-lived. So someone goes out in the field in the morning, starting, you know, with the sun rising, and you have to get these flowers pollinated before lunchtime. So one flower, one bean, one flower, one bean, one flower, one bean, until you get tons of beans. Those of you who are a little more aware of what you're buying in the store, because of some of these challenges, you're seeing blended extracts in the store. So it's price prohibitive to get pure extract now, so they're blending it with artificial vanillin, which is a lot cheaper but doesn't give you the bouquet of aromas that some of us expect. And of course, geopolitical challenges, sometimes under-regulated industry, as well as the fact you just can't get what you need. And there's a number of different issues here, but I'll just skip over those. Vanilla needs to be processed in order to develop the aroma that you expect, and this is a lengthy, drawn-out process. So if you were to start a new vanillary, it looks something like here. You would go in a jungle system. You take a cutting of a Tudor tree. The Tudor tree provides like a trellis for the vanilla as well as shade. Vanilla doesn't handle full sun, especially in places like the tropics where we get plenty of sun. Then you'll take a 1 meter long cutting of your vanilla. You'll make sure a node or two is in contact with the soil, and then you'll tie that to the tree. And you let that grow for 2 to 3 years, depending on the health of the vine. Then you go through your pollination, and then you get beans in 8 to 9 months, depending on environmental factors. And then you go through a process of harvesting and curing. And so those of you who prefer toasted bread, compared to fresh bread, or if you like to toast a marshmallow, those type of Maillard reaction products. We're talking about flavor development over time as the vanilla bean actually breaks down. Shown here on the silver tray are two different species of vanilla. When you're buying truckloads of vanilla, you can't actually sell one of these species and call it vanilla extract, so they have to sort them out and find buyers for both. They do a number of steps of drying. They'll take the beans out for 2 hours and dry them in the sun and bring them back in and do this for a couple of months, very labor intensive. And then that's shipped to the U.S. as beans, and then it gets extracted here by our major flavor and fragrance houses. So just quickly, in terms of vanilla genomics, if you were to print the vanilla genome in 12-point font, it would reach from Miami to Seattle. And part of genomics is finding those rare and small regions of that genome where there might be a single base pair that influences something like flavor or disease resistance. And in terms of genetics, if you were to fill every seat in a major stadium, so this is Ben Griffin Hill at UF, each one of those people would represent one gene. They've all got their cell phones and their clicks and their jerseys and all these things, and they're working together, and we're trying to figure out who's doing what. Historically, in vanilla, this has been limited to single gene sequences where you will amplify a hyper-conserved sequence, usually plasid-derived. You spend your $5 to get it sequenced, and you get maybe 5 data points if you're lucky. Very expensive and poor resolution. In general, you can separate species this way, though some of the more closely related material, obviously, you cannot. So in our study, we took 112 accessions, mostly focusing on Planifolia and Pompona, developed or identified over 500,000 SNPs and used 5,000 of those to separate based on species. And this is the first time that we've been able to do this and try and get a better idea of what is a species in vanilla. Putting together in the ovals broad characterizations of species. You've got Planifolia at the bottom. We've got Pompona at the top. We've got Tahitensis here. And I'm showing the four native species on the far side here. So in South Florida, I can actually go out into preserve land and make collections of our native species down there and see if those have interesting disease resistance traits or eventually could lead to improved quality. One of the things we were not expecting, this is a basic cladogram with a structure analysis, we found that about 12% of the accessions out there were hybrids. And for a species that requires manual pollination and a little bit of protection for these little baby seeds, we weren't expecting that, as well as the fact that around 11% were misidentified, even from botanical gardens. So as true for most tropical crops, a lot of times we just don't even know what we have. Which was true for 100% of the Tahitensis clones that we obtained from botanical gardens and online. Every single one of them was either Planifolia or Pompona. So you pay a little bit more for getting something that's actually not what you want. So big caution out there, and something we're working on now to help our growers to make sure they're growing something that is what they want. So our vision going forward is trying to leverage things like natural pollinators so we don't have to manually pollinate every flower. We're interested in niche and specialty types for South Florida. We don't want to compete against Madagascar, where labor is much cheaper, right? So we can grow hybrids, and we'll just call it, we can't call it vanilla extract. We can certainly call it something else, and we can sell it up the East Coast for hopefully higher prices that delight our consumers, concomitant with the increase in price. Looking at cheaper ways to produce instead of under shade houses, maybe underneath palm trees, underneath fruit trees existing, and then, of course, putting on labels like fresh from Florida, which makes people that live up north feel warm, and in especially the winter months. And now we're working on species-specific markers, so we can get an accession in, and that same day we can tell you if it's Planifolia or if it's Pompona or a hybrid. So lots of fun things going, and of course my lab smells absolutely wonderful on our vanilla days. I have the best smelling office, as well as we keep the beans out for demonstration purposes. Like any lab, I've got a great team, and this is the view outside my window in January, so be very jealous. And if you'd like more information, my website, email, as well as this has recently been published in Scientific Reports. Thank you.